Good morning, everybody. Welcome to the regular May session of the ISB board meeting. We are going to discuss amendments to IFRS 17, a couple of sweep issues, and I give the floor to Anne McGeachin.
Thanks, Hans. Good morning, everyone. Today we want to run through some sweep issues on the amendments to IFRS 17 that we identified during the balloting process. Once we've got your decisions on these matters, we can complete the drafting process and we expect to send you a ballot draft in the next few weeks. The issues are set out in Agenda Papers 2 and 2A. Paper 2A catches a couple of issues from feedback we received just last week. So the first issue is on pre-recognition cash flows. It relates to cash flows related to a group of insurance contracts that are paid or received before the group of insurance contracts is recognised. It's set out in paragraphs 7 to 11 of Agenda Paper 2. So IFRS 17 includes specific requirements relating to insurance acquisition cash flows that are paid before a group of insurance contracts is recognised. But IFRS 17 is silent on the accounting for cash flows that do not meet the definition. And by cash flows that relate to the group of insurance contracts, we mean any cash flows that would be fulfillment cash flows upon IFRS 17 if they were paid or received after the recognition of the group of insurance contracts. We therefore recommend that the board amend IFRS 17 to require an entity to include in the initial measurement of the contribution of a group of insurance contracts.
And you're not, it's sometimes cutting away a little bit. I think it's better you put off the camera.
Sure.
Yeah, turn off.
Okay,
yeah.
I will do that. If I can, I can't see the, oh, got it. Okay, I hope that's better.
Yeah.
Okay, so, we recommend that the board amend IFRS 17 to require an entity to include in the initial measurement of the contractual service margin of a group of insurance contracts the effect of derecognition of any asset or liability previously recognised for cash flows related to the group that are paid or received before the group is recognised. This is question one on page 4 of Agenda Paper 2. I should also note that we need to just check that the wording of the revenue paragraphs works as intended once we have these additional pre-recognition cash flows. Now hand over to the board for discussion.
Does anybody want to comment? No, then I guess we support the staff's recommendation. Can I see hands?
Tom?
Okay.
Well, I guess Tom, is your hand raised? And I don't see Mary. Oh, there you are, Mary. Okay. Yep, I got Mary.
Yeah.
I don't see Tom's hand raised, so I'm going to say 13.
Okay.
I think Tom's trying to say something, but Tom, you're on mute. You're still on mute.
Yeah. Okay. Well, while Tom is unmuting, I think we can go on to the next issue.
Okay. So I'm now going to skip out of the order in the papers. Sorry. I'm going to skip to a related issue to the one we've just voted on that's set out in paragraphs 9 to 13 of Agenda Paper 2A. So this is a similar issue, but it's not about the type of cash flow, so whether it's an insurance acquisition cash flow or another type of cash flow, but whether the cash flow is actually being paid before the recognition of the group of insurance contracts or just accrued by the recognition of the
liability. I'm going to need that screen because this is no good.
Now you
well,
are
now we,
Tom.
Oh. Now you're on there, Tom.
Oh. Sorry, I had to get out. I voted in favor. I don't know what happened. I had to re-sign in. My apologies.
Okay. All right, fine. Thank you. So we have 14 on the previous vote. Okay, Anne, continue, please.
Okay. Yeah, so this isn't about the sort of the nature of the cash flows, but the timing, whether they've been actually paid before the recognition of the group insurance contracts or accrued through the recognition of a liability applying another IFRS standard. If the cash flow meets the definition of an insurance acquisition cash flow, the liability for the accrual of that cash flow cannot at the moment give rise to a corresponding asset for insurance acquisition cash flows, because the wording in IFRS 17 restricts that asset to cash flows actually paid. As with the previous issue, the staff think that all the cash flows that relate to the group of insurance contracts should be included in the calculation of the contractual service margin on initial recognition, regardless of their timing. We therefore recommend that the board amend IFRS 17 so that to require the recognition of an asset for insurance acquisition cash flows to include future insurance acquisition cash flows for which a liability has been recognised applying another IFRS standard. This is question 2 on page 4 of Agenda Paper 2A. I'll hand over to the board for discussion.
No discussion. So can we see who agrees? Sue?
I had my hand up, I thought, but yes, I agree.
Yeah. Okay.
So 14?
All right.
Okay, I'll now hand over to Laura to talk about reinsurance contracts held.
Laura.
Thanks. Thanks, Anne. Thanks, Hans. Good morning, everyone. So we'll skip back now to Agenda Paper 2, topic B, which starts on paragraph 12, and that's on the amendment for reinsurance contracts held and underlying contracts are onerous. In the redeliberations, the board decided that the amendment would not be limited to only proportionate reinsurance, as was proposed in the ED. And in addition to that, the amendment would not be limited to apply insurance contracts to every insurance contract in a group. As we're now coming around to updating the drafting, we noted that there's a need to amend the wording of the requirement for calculating the loss recovery amount on the reinsurance contract, so that the wording of that calculation will reflect the board's decisions in the redeliberations. In the exposure draft, the calculation had referred to a loss from a group buying insurance contract.
Laura, you're cutting away. Can you just turn off the camera and retake it from a couple of sentences ago, please?
Yeah, no problem. Okay, hopefully that will help. Let me know if it's still
cutting. Yeah, this is better.
Cutting out. Okay. Around to updating the drafting, we noted that there's a need to amend the wording for calculating the loss recovery amount on a reinsurance contract, so that the wording of that calculation reflects the board's decisions in the redeliberations. In the exposure draft, the calculation had referred to a loss recognised on a group of underlying insurance contracts. We think that if that drafting was retained, it would imply that underlying insurance contracts can't be in the same group as other insurance contracts not covered by the reinsurance. So the alternative drafting would be to instead contracts without referring to groups. We think that if we amended the drafting in that way, without that drafting could be interpreting an entity to track contract at a level lower than normal, which would not be consistent with the requirements of IFRS 17. Therefore, in this paper, we're recommending that the board add requirements so that when those onerous contracts covered by a reinsurance contract are in the same group as other insurance contracts not covered by the reinsurance, an entity would use a systematic and rational method to determine the portion of the losses on the group that is covered by the reinsurance contract. We think that requiring an entity to use a systematic and rational allocation would be consistent with the requirements of IFRS 17. Since the paper was reposted, we've received feedback. One piece of feedback from an insurer related to the recommended, which is set out in Appendix A of the team. In the final thing, that an entity shall...
Guys, am I the only one who is having a problem understanding Laura, or...
Laura, would it just help if I just provide this last piece of feedback that you wanted to report?
Yeah, please do.
Absolutely.
Henry.
Okay, and Laura can just sort of correct me if I got it wrong. But I think what Laura was highlighting was since we actually posted the paper, we did receive some feedback relating to the recommended drafting, which you can see in the appendix of this paper on page 14. And it's in the final sentence, we say the entity shall apply the same systematic and rational method that it uses initially in subsequent measurement. And the feedback that we've received is that an entity might have more granular information at initial recognition compared to the information it'll have on subsequent measurement. And the wording that we have in the drafting in Appendix A could imply that an entity would actually be prohibited from using that more granular information, which is not obviously what we are intending. And so in the light of that feedback, if the board agrees with the recommendation in the paper, we would amend the drafting to refer only to using a systematic and rational method of allocation, both at initial recognition and on subsequent measurement, without specifying those methods must be the same. So I think that was the feedback that Laura was going to report. And so now I'll hand back to the board to discuss this topic B, and then we'll pick up on the question in the paper.
Okay. Anybody? No?
Put the chat box.
So this is... Oh, okay. Yes, Mary.
Question for the insurance team. Well, I have no objection to the consequence of the recommendation, i.e., that we are not precluding including contracts that are underlying reinsurance contracts in a group with contracts that are not underlying reinsurance contracts. I'm okay with that. And I'm okay with using a systematic and rational method for allocation. I really question both the need and the wisdom, the need for and the wisdom of giving this explicit guidance on using, telling people that in this circumstance you do this. And the reason I have that question is not only the risk that it raises more questions, you know, like the feedback that you heard once the paper was posted, but that we're going to a level of detail about here's how you do it, when basically what we're saying is some of the accounting that's required is going to involve the use of estimates. And I can see that we would need to comment that we are not requiring underlying to be in a separate group from contracts that are not underlying reinsurance contracts, but and just observing that may mean some kind of estimation, but I'm not comfortable with going the extra step in terms of saying thou shalt do this in this circumstance, because I think it does raise some questions about whether estimation is necessary elsewhere. And it could be seen as giving relief from use of more granular information if you have it in some circumstances. So I guess I'd just like the staff to comment about costs and benefits and why they think it's necessary to have as a requirement in the standard rather than some kind of discussion about what the consequences of the amendment is, consequences are, sorry.
Hi, Mary, it's Laura. I'll try to come in, and if I cut out, I think I'll hand over to someone else on the team to answer that. So in this specific scenario, we do think that the requirements are specifically needed in the wording of the standard. The requirements in IFRS 17 are set out so that an entity recognises and measures groups. The language we're going to be using here in these paragraphs specifically will ask an entity to calculate an amount that might be at a lower level than the group. So we think the standard needs to explain in this scenario how you do that, because an entity can't get there using its usual IFRS 17 measurement alone. It needs to go one step further and do an allocation. Saying that, though, I think your point is a really good one, that, you know, the more we insert these kind of requirements into the standard, saying where you use a systematic and rational method, it risks implying that those methods can't be used to achieve requirements elsewhere, which we don't think is the case. So we think it would be helpful if we explained very specifically why the words are needed in this particular scenario. That reminds me also, actually, we had another piece of feedback this week from an insurer. It was supportive of this staff recommendation, and it also asked that there is another area in the reinsurance amendments, reinsurance requirements, sorry, where they'd like to use a systematic and rational method to achieve what the requirements are asking. Now, that's a place where we think the language isn't restricting an entity from doing that, so there isn't a need to add these specific requirements in. So it sort of shows there's an important differentiation here where why we think it's specifically needed here and not in other places.
Okay, Daryl?
Oh, you missed me, Hans.
Oh, Sue, well, you'll come.
I was in fact just about to send you a message, Hans, to say that I can't better what Laura just said, so I'd rather stay quiet. I agree exactly with what she said, and I think the idea of putting something in the basis just to make sure we understand why this is different from other circumstances is appropriate.
Sue.
Thanks. I'm not sure I'd vote against it, given we are where we are in terms of timing and not wanting to disrupt implementation and all of those things. But I did want to just flag a bit of concern with this. And my concern is that if somebody has the information available without undue cost or effort to do something that sort of actually identifies the contracts that are sort of linked to the reinsurance in a more specific way, I feel like this gives them a little bit of a get out of jail card to not have to bother to do it. And I would have preferred us to not require tracking if it was, you know, too difficult to do, but at least to have a notion of undue cost or effort. Now, maybe it's too late to do that now, but I just wanted to say that that makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable. And just on the, sorry, Henry, the point that you raised in response to the comment that had come in during the week, I can completely understand why, if somebody is able to do something more specific on initial recognition, and then later on they need to do something that's more of an estimation approach because it's more difficult to obtain the information over time, that of course it would be perfectly sensible for us to allow them to go from that more specific approach to an estimation approach, because that's sort of the best they can do in the circumstances, and actually they would, you know, doing the best they could in both instances. But if we don't ask people to do it consistently over time, that's going to open up the people that are just using estimation approaches to flip-flopping around, aren't we, in terms of what they're doing. It's not going to limit it to the good guy who was doing something more specific on initial recognition and then needed to change to an approximation method later on. So I guess I'm just a little bit nervous about unintended consequences and sort of the quality of what might be going on.
Does the staff want to respond or?
I'll respond on that one, if that's okay. So we thought about that as well, Sue, about if you take away the same, what does that mean? Ultimately, we got comfortable that we thought systematic and rational methods would be an appropriate level of restriction. We do think that, you know, having systematic methods does imply that if you have the same level of information available across time, you would continue to use the same approach. But if information became at a different level at different times, you would need to adapt your approach to whatever information you've got available. So we ended up feeling comfortable that systematic and rational would be helpful wording to have there.
You're optimistic, Daryl. Yeah. Oh.
Daryl, you're mute.
Probably wanted to echo again what Laura just said. So I think Sue, you're probably correct in saying that if this was a different time point, we might have wanted to explore further how we thought people could develop that information. Because I think the concern for me is I think this type of thing of having more information available at the beginning and then sort of working your way into less information over time, just because as you're originating the contract, you're going to have more information, I think is going to happen on an ongoing basis. So it may be that we want to try and refine the words, but I'm very nervous about putting in some sort of undue cost and effort type test, because I think it would have to happen all of the time on an ongoing basis. And I just don't know that we understand how much work would be involved in it. So I kind of supported where the staff were when I first read the paper, having listened to the feedback that we were getting during the course of the last 10 days. And Henry's point, I'm personally comfortable with where the staff have now landed.
Okay, can I see who supports the staff recommendation?
Sue and Mary. Nope. All right. 12.
Yeah. Nope. Okay. All right. Who is going to lead us further? Anne?
I'll hand over to Vita now, who will introduce the next topic.
Okay. Vita?
Thank you, Laura. Thank you, Hans. Good morning, everyone. I'm going to talk you through topic C on insurance revenue and income tax. Topic C starts in paragraph 19 in the agenda paper 2 and is a consequential sweep issue to the amendment for income tax amounts that are specifically chargeable to the policyholder under the terms of an insurance contract. At the February board meeting, in order to resolve an inconsistency between paragraph B66F and paragraph B65M of the standard, the board decided to amend FRS 17. To require an entity to include in the fulfillment cash flows income tax amounts that are specifically chargeable to the policyholder under the terms of an insurance contract. After the amendment, an entity will account for those income tax amounts applying IAS 12 income taxes, and at the same time include those amounts in the fulfillment cash flows applying FRS 17. Accordingly, when an entity incurs income tax expenses that are specifically chargeable to the policyholder under the terms of an insurance contract, the entity will need to reduce the liability for remaining coverage and recognize insurance revenue. To achieve this intended consequence, the staff note that a further amendment is needed to paragraph B121A of FRS 17 that describes the composition of revenue in FRS 17. At present, this paragraph, B121A, refers only to expenses that are insurance service expenses. Income tax amounts cannot be defined as insurance service expenses because they are required by IS1 to be presented separately in profit or loss. Therefore, the staff recommend the board amend paragraph B121A of FRS 17 to require an entity to recognize insurance revenue when the entity recognizes in profit or loss income tax amounts that are specifically chargeable to the policyholder. I will now hand over to the board to discuss topic C, which is question 3 in the paper 2.
Okay. Nobody? Can I assume we agree with the staff's recommendation? Yes.
Mary, your video is frozen.
Yes.
Okay, 14.
Okay. Who is continuing? We're not at the end yet.
Yeah, no, we're not at the end yet. I'll continue. So the next issue is on the definitions of the liability for remaining coverage and the liability for incurred claims. So some respondents to the exposure draft observed that the definitions of the liability for remaining coverage and the liability for incurred claims are incomplete. They don't cover all of an entity's obligations that are created by a group of insurance contracts. And this is true. The definitions in IFRS 17, as issued in May 2017, focused on distinguishing, on one hand, future claims for insured events, and on the other hand, incurred claims, because the provision of insurance coverage was the differentiator between the two liabilities. But now we've introduced investment-type services, as well as insurance coverage, into IFRS 17. The exposure draft introduced those services into the definitions of the liability for remaining coverage and the liability for incurred claims. But it's clear that the more that we sort of specify and include in the definitions specifically, almost the more obvious the things that are missing become. And therefore, the staff recommend that for completeness, the board amend IFRS 17 to include in the definitions of the liability for remaining coverage and the liability for all incurred claims all obligations that arise from a group of insurance contracts issued by an entity. This is question 4 on page 9 of Agenda Paper 2. I'll hand over to the board for discussion.
Again, no discussion, which means it's a true sweep issue. Sue.
I'm voting.
Oh, okay. All right. you see, these virtual meetings are not without their challenges.
All right, 14.
All right.
Okay, great. Right, the next issue. So the next issue is to do with the interaction of the OCI option and the risk mitigation option. And it's set out on paragraphs 30 to 38 of Agenda Paper 2. So an entity may choose to apply both the risk mitigation option and the OCI option in IFRS 17. If it does that, when it's achieving derivative or non-derivative financial assets measured at fair value P&L, and is also required to use the current period book yield in applying the OCI option, it will recognize the change in the mitigating instrument in profit or loss and the effect of the mitigated risks in OCI. The staff think that this inevitable mismatch under the way that IFRS 17 is currently worded, from when applying both options, unduly restricts the application of the two options. So the staff therefore recommend that the OCI option currently in IFRS 17 should not apply to insurance finance income or expenses created by the risk mitigation option. Instead, requirements should be added to the risk mitigation option to require changes in the insurance contract liability that are mitigated using derivatives or other financial assets measured fair value P&L to be recognized in profit or loss. Entities can also apply the risk mitigation option when mitigating risk using reinsurance contracts held. In this case, changes in the mitigating instrument, the reinsurance contract held, might be recognized in profit or loss, or in profit or loss and other comprehensive income. So for insurance finance income or expenses created by risk mitigation using reinsurance contracts held, the staff recommend that an entity should be required to apply the same OCI accounting policy choice the entity has chosen for the mitigating reinsurance contracts held. This is question 5 on page 12 of Agenda Paper 2. Hand over to the board for discussion.
Mary wants to come in, Hans.
Okay, Mary.
No objections to the staff proposal for question five. A bit of philosophy, something that I just like to say in the hopes that we remember it, in the hope that we remember it in other projects, which is, we've come again and again with the OCI option to increasing complexity in the standard. First, the need to do risk mitigation, and then reconsider what's eligible for risk mitigation, et cetera. And I think it is just a warning for us as standard setters to think really hard about options and the complexity they can produce in the standard and applying the standard when we are trying to evaluate the feedback we're getting about people maybe having valid concerns about accounting mismatches, but focusing perhaps narrowly on the issue at hand. And I think we've seen this particular issue bring a lot of complexity into the standard in the drafting. So I think given where we are, I'm fine with the staff recommendation to address this issue we've become aware of, but I just want us to try and collectively remember it for future standard setting projects in terms of it being an additional cost.
Yes, Mary, completely agree with you. Other than our proposals around annual cohorts, we have received very little feedback by the industry of the cost and complexity of this issue, because they wanted it themselves. Okay. Any other comments? No. Can we vote?
Fourteen.
Great, thank you. And now, finally, the last issue, which is set out in paragraphs 5 to 8 of Agenda Paper 2A. And this relates to paragraph B96C of IFRS 17, which sets out requirements for the effects of investment components that are unexpectedly paid or unexpectedly not paid in a period. In the exposure draft of amendments to IFRS 17, the board proposed amendments to that paragraph that were intended to ensure that insurance finance income or expenses were properly identified and did not adjust the contractual service margin. However, it's become clear from feedback that the amendment in the ED is confusing and does not always achieve what was intended. The staff therefore recommend different wording that does achieve what the board intended, and that is set out in the appendix to Agenda Paper 2A. So this is question one on page 3 of Agenda Paper 2A. Hand over to the board for discussion.
No discussion? No. Can we vote for the staff's proposal? Okay.
Tom and Francoise. Okay, see Francoise, Tom. 14.
14. Okay. All right. That brings us to the end of this agenda item. We have a break planned at 11 o'clock. We are way ahead. Should we still have that break now so that the management commentary staff can prepare itself?
Yeah, they'll just need a couple minutes to get on, but they have a longer session. Do you want to still have a little bit of a break?
Yeah, let's break till 11:45. 10:45.